Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show, hosted by author, investor, money partner, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, this is Bruce Norris. Welcome to our show. Today we're joined by Jack Kaiser. He's a Senior Vice President and Chief Economist on the staff of the Los Angeles County Economic Development Corporation. He's referred to as the guru of the Los Angeles economy. And Jack, we're just very honored to have you here today.
It's a pleasure to talk with you.
When you prepare for a forecast, is it increasingly necessary to take into an account what's going on in the rest of the world?
Very definitely. People don't understand that Southern California is an international business center. So you have to find out what's going on in Asia, especially China, but also Japan. You have to look to Europe. You have to look to Canada and Mexico. And then the other thing that you have to look at is the very diverse economic base that we have, trying to figure out what's going on in everything from agriculture to aerospace. So it takes literally ongoing study.
Now, you started doing this a long time ago. Has that significantly changed in its complexity over those, let's say, 25 years or so?
Oh, yes. It's gotten much more complex. If you look back, the international trade industry really did not show up on the scene until 1994. Then it became a significant factor in the growth of the region. And right now, it looks like there's sort of a shift in trend in international trade, which could be important to several areas in the state, so you have that to look at. Aerospace is much diminished. Then you have the motion picture industry, and it's facing its own special set of challenges. So you've got a lot of stuff happening.
Well, let's talk about the Writers Guild. I know that's what you were mentioning. You got a strike that might happen on Thursday. Just how important is the entertainment industry to the L.A. Area?
It's very important. The motion picture industry is the third largest source of jobs in L.A. County. It hits a lot of activities. People don't think about it, but it uses a lot of inputs. It has, as we say, a high multiplier. And just so much uncertainty because we don't know if the writers will walk off. And then June 30th of next year, you have the Screen Actors and Directors Guild contracts both expiring. So you're in for about 12 months of a lot of uncertainty. If the writers go and throw up picket lines, then everything comes to a grinding halt in the entertainment industry. And that is already having an impact. As we say, we're in the de facto strike situation where you have people working, people are trying to get products done, but the workers in the industry are saving their money. You talk to restaurateurs in the Southeast San Fernando Valley, and they say business is way off. People aren't going to think about buying a car or possibly going out and looking at a home until all this uncertainty is gone.
The last time this occurred was when, and how long did it last?
You had an actual strike by the writers in 1988. It was about a five-month affair. Estimated loss of wages was about $500 million, which was a significant amount of money. And then in 2001, you did have a de facto strike because the Screen Actors were threatening to go out. And so you had people put product in the can, so to speak. And then in the second half of 2001, early 2002, a very low level of activity in the industry. So here again, you've had shifts in the way this industry sort of goes through and handles strikes. You know, you have the threat and then you have the de facto strike. So it's an interesting change that a lot of people don't recognize.
When you do forecasts, and this is a question just in general economics, why is it that economists can look at the same set of statistics and the same history of those statistics and come to very different conclusions?
You've noticed that, haven't you?
I have.
Yeah, it's very funny because every morning I go to a website called Rough and Tumble. It gives you headlines from around the state. And a couple of days ago here was one story of somebody saying, well, growth is going to be slow, but there's no recession. And then the next article that was cited was recession is looming and, you know, prepare. It just depends on where they are coming from. You know, how do you approach it? Do you have any philosophical ideas that influences you? So it's interesting because, well, remember the old joke. You know, Harry Truman always wanted a one-armed economist, and somebody said, why? And he said, well, an economist will come into the room and said, on one hand, this can happen. On the other hand, that can happen.
Does a lot of times the conclusions that they come to then begin with the bent that they maybe want to occur?
I think it does. As I say, you know, have they gone to a specific school and they have their theories, economic theories, that this is what's going to happen. This is the most important thing. It's, as I say, economists are an interesting group of people, not the most scintillating people, but they're interesting, and just trying to figure out where they are coming from.
Looking back, was there some theory of economics that you were once sure of that over time you had to come to a different conclusion?
No, it's sort of, you sort of learn as you go forward. You can't be, too doctrinaire. There was one of the first ladies who was on the board of the Federal Reserve, and she said she practiced garbage economics and took a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and that helped her determine what was going to happen. So I think you have to weave so many things together. Right now people are wringing their hands about the decline in the value of the U.S. dollar and say, well, this is a threat to us. And yet in Southern California, the agriculture industry is benefiting, the tourism industry is benefiting, some technology sectors are benefiting because the lower dollar means that we're more competitive in global markets.
Mm-hmm. From 2002 to 2006, Californians enjoyed a tremendous gain in the value of our properties. And in your opinion, did that create permanent wealth or a spending binge?
It's very interesting. If you bought your home early on and didn't do too much in the way of refinancing, you've probably got a tidy little nest egg. But if you were buying your home in the second half of 2005, 2006, even early 2007, and was using subprime loans, you're probably very, very nervous. One thing that we are finding out more and more is that speculators were a significant factor in this market, and you see a lot of smaller areas in Southern California that have really gotten hurt by what we call the speculator trap.
Okay, let's talk about the speculator. Why do you think the speculator had such a big impact then?
Well, but they were going in and buying a home. They were going to try to flip it. It sort of gave the impression that the market was stronger than it really was. These people were, it was an investment. This is what they were going to make a lot of money off of. And what you have to look at the housing market is, it's not an investment. It's a place to live that has some attractive tax benefits. But if you look at a home as an investment, a residential structure, sooner or later you're going to come to grief. You look at what happened in Orange County, or in the Irvine area, and about a year ago, the big thing was high-rise condos, and some people were sort of scratching their head and saying, is Orange County, which is a traditional low-rise single-family market, are they ready for high-rise condos? And everybody was saying, oh, yes, there is a market out there, and there are all these plans to build all these high-rises, and all of a sudden the demand disappeared, and determined it was mostly speculators that were jumping in, and they thought this was the next big thing.
Okay, now speculators, typically, were they attracted to the new housing tracts?
They tended to be attracted to the new housing tracts, although you see speculators going into older areas and buying homes and then doing what you traditionally call in the industry a sparkle plenty to make them look more attractive. Or in some areas, like I live in Downey, which was developed right after World War II, and so you have smaller, older sort of tract type of homes on good-sized lots. And people have gone in there and bought these homes, turned them down, and built these great big neo-Mediterranean units that sort of bloom like elephants over everything else. And I can see in Downey that a lot of, you probably had a lot of speculators, and people have lost homes to foreclosure. It's very interesting when you watch the mentality of some of these people.
Well, I am one of those people, just so you know. I mean, we do what we call investing. Mm-hmm. What would be your opinion of an investor versus a speculator?
A speculator wants to make easy money, quick money. That's how I would characterize a speculator.
Okay. An investor is not ashamed when that happens, too, but they also have maybe a long-term plan as
they have,
well.
They have a longer-term time frame. I think that's how you separate the two.
Okay. With this decline in equity, do you see consumer spending being affected by next year?
I think a lot of people are going to be cutting back. They're going to be cautious because the news media until just the last week, has been literally running a housing scare story a week. And what you have to look at, the housing market, yes, you have people that have subprime loans, and a lot of these people are going to get hurt by the resets that are coming up early next year. But then you have a lot of people that own their homes free and clear. You have a lot of people that have either 15 or 30-year mortgages at a very, very attractive interest rate, and unless they were thinking about selling, they're just sort of sitting there and watching this all. And so you have, it depends on how you feel about your job. If you're in a sector that's growing, you probably won't cut back your spending patterns that much. If you're a little bit uncertain about your industry, you probably would start to cut back. Most standard forecasts for Christmas this year say a 3 to 4% increase over the previous year's Christmas season. The retail industry has reacted accordingly. They've cut back on the merchandise that they are ordering. So you could get into the Christmas season and stores start running out. It could be very interesting.
Mm-hmm. What percentage of troubled property owners does it take to cause problems for the rest of them?
Well, it's basically, you have to say, you have an area that has a lot of foreclosed properties, and people have said, okay, the Moreno Valley, the Coachella Valley are going to be where a lot of the problems are. If you have a neighborhood that has a lot of foreclosed homes, they're sitting there with unwatered lawns, nothing being trimmed, and they start to look really messy, that causes problems for everybody in the neighborhood, and I think that is a real concern. But foreclosures are going to have an impact on local government finance because as property values come down, people who own homes that are being taxed at a higher price level, they're going to start to go to the county assessors and saying, can we get a reassessment down? So some of the local governments are already factoring this into their plans for the next year.
When counties collect the property taxes, how do they spend that? Where does that money generally go?
It goes to a whole array of sources. When you get your tax bill, you just look at it and you start to scratch your head and say, I didn't realize there were so many entities out there that got a share of my tax dollar. And you have things like water replenishment districts. You can have street lighting districts, street districts, all kinds of districts out there. And then, of course, the city gets a little bit of the money, and the county does too. But there are just a lot of entities that depend on the property tax.
When a shortfall occurs, how do they make that up, or do we just do without whatever service that would have funded?
What they do is they cut back. You may not get your trees trimmed as often as you would have hoped. You may not get the street repaved as often as you would like. It just sort of ripples through the economy, and people complain about it. You see some governments talking about increasing taxes of varying types to try to cover shortfalls. So the next 3 years are going to be very interesting for local government. And then you go to Sacramento, and they are facing a budget deficit, and that ripples down, especially to county governments.
Okay. Now, does that typically cost government jobs then?
Yeah. What happens, people leave, what you call natural attrition, and the government sector may not replace that job. And what we've seen is that government has been growing rapidly all around Southern California over about the past 2 or 3 years because their budgets have been pretty flush. Everybody looks at the construction industry and saying, oh, wow, the growth was powered by construction. In the last couple of 3 years, it's being powered also by government.
If the number three employer for L.A. is the film industry, what are the number one and two?
Number one is direct international trade. We've got the largest port complex in the United States, fifth largest in the world. And then number two is the tourism industry, and some good things are happening in tourism. So that protects us. And then you have professional business services, which includes computer programming, accounting, law. Law is really going to have a lot to work with because I think you're going to have a lot of lawsuits arising out of the subprime lending debacle. And then you also have other things that are out there that people really don't think about, leisure and hospitality, but also health services. Everybody is getting older, and the baby boomers are going to be big consumers of health services, so that's growing rapidly.
Do you think a change in spending habits because of less equity will ultimately create a recession?
It could. It depends on what happens. We're waiting to see how the Federal Reserve reacts to everything that's going on, still concerned about the health of the financial markets. And then you have to look around the whole U.S., and people don't think about this, but you go into the Midwest, you have the Detroit 3, GM, Chrysler, and Ford negotiating contracts with the UAW. And in all this contract negotiation, you're going to see the result is that all of those three are going to be closing plants. The Midwest is really going to get hammered, and they've had a lot of housing problems. And then the other thing is that the big Detroit 3 all admit that they have way too many dealerships, and they're going to be trying to close dealerships. And for a smaller community that, say, had a Ford dealership, and all of a sudden the Ford dealership closes down, that could really present some problems, because auto dealers are very desirable because of the sales tax revenue they generate.
You know, one of the problems with those the big three car makers is the promises that they made to past employees.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of similar to what's coming up for the United States, where we have a lot of the baby boomer generation retiring. So taking a look way into the future, maybe 10 or 15 years, do you view that we're going to have to pay that bill by either reducing the benefits that we promised or raising taxes to a smaller group of workers?
It's probably going to be a combination, and then there's a third aspect there. I think you're going to see a lot of baby boomers deciding that they're going to work past 65, the traditional retirement age, and they're doing it because they're concerned about their financial well-being. But you're going to find a lot of companies that are encouraging this, because a lot of the companies that you talk to, they're concerned. The baby boomers are getting ready to retire. We can't find workers with the skills to replace them. So it's going to be interesting. It's not going to be the traditional 65 or 62, and then I retire and go out and play golf or tennis. It's going to be a changed world.
Mm-hmm. The Fed's decision tomorrow, do you attach much significance to whether they reduce interest rates again?
I think most people in the financial markets are expecting a modest interest rate cut. We just have to see what the Fed does do. There's concern about inflation, and you have the problems in with oil prices, but also food prices. And so I think if the Fed does not cut interest rates, the financial markets will be a little bit disappointed. There's just a lot of things going on out there. We could have a lousy earnings report. There's a lot of uncertainty in this sector right now. So as we say, stand by. We've been through a lot, but more could be coming, so be brave.
Is there anything in the horizon, let's say, of the next 3 or 4 years that could force the Fed to raise rates substantially, do you think?
If you had some hostilities break out over in the Middle East, say Turkey goes in to the northern half of Iran after the Kurds, that could cause a lot of instability. We have to keep our eye on Mexico, because Mexico hasn't managed their oil resources very well, and their production is declining more rapidly than anybody had estimated. There's a lot of things that could cause a flare-up in inflation. We saw a bump up in corn prices because everybody was chasing after ethanol. That was the next big thing, and now all of a sudden people are realizing, well, hey, there's some problems here. And maybe it's not the next big thing, but it definitely caused a spike in food costs. So you just don't know what is going to happen. You've gotten a period where you just have to expect constant uncertainty. Something could come out of left field. You can try to sort of scan the horizon and see if you can determine what it might be, but a lot of times these things aren't well reported, and bam, then there you are.
In the real estate downturn between, let's say, 1980 and 84, we had to fight inflation, had very high interest rates. Between 90 and 96, we had a change in government spending, and we lost a lot of jobs.
Mm-hmm.
What's the main cause for the current real estate downturn?
We'd have to say poor lending practices. People were pushing the subprime loans. A lot of people were trying to get into the housing market and didn't really do the research. And then you had the speculators. You can't say one factor caused it all. It was a combination of factors. And I think probably you're going to get a lot of regulation proposed out of Washington, D.C. Remember, we're in a presidential election cycle. So you're going to have the people in Washington, D.C. trying to protect us.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's talk about that. Is their intervention a wise thing in the long run?
Well, they go into it. And you have to say, what is their motivation? Do they really want to prevent problems from happening in the future, or is it sort of grandstanding? And a lot of times, what you're seeing now is just a lot of grandstanding. They see a TV camera and they snap too, and it's kind of disappointing. And you have, it's well, you don't want to get me started about politicians, because sometimes I can get carried away.
Okay. Well, I think it's worthwhile in this sense, because if they make decisions that are in the short run very popular, they could also be very damaging to the future of liquidity.
Oh, yeah.
So they got to be very careful what they do.
Yeah, it's what we call the law of unintended consequences. And generally what they're doing is say, we want to take this action, and it's going to solve this single problem. But what they don't understand is, well, they try to solve a problem, but they cause other problems down the road. So you have to be very, very careful in situations like this.
What allowed lenders who are pretty well known to be conservative to make loans without making the borrower really prove anything? I know you have a background having worked with Security Pacific. I doubt that that loan was available back then.
Oh, no. Oh, no. No, I think you're going to see going forward that lending institutions are very, very strict in the way they make their loans. You have to have impeccable credit if you're a consumer or you're a business. And it's going to be a real challenge, and I think you're going to see we're in a period now where it's much more rigorous in the lending process.
Well, in a way, that's going to create quite a dilemma. You've got a lot of people that got into real estate with the loan programs that allowed them to exaggerate their income, let's say, and got adjustable loans. Now you've kind of changed the rules and locked them in to where they can't get out.
Yeah, and then you have another dilemma out there. In Southern California, we have a lot of people that don't work at regular jobs. Best example is the film industry. A lot of people in that industry work on a project-by-project basis. You see it in other sectors, professional and business services. You have the independent truck drivers down at the ports. They're all independent business people, and they don't have a steady income. And this could cause some problems for people that do work as independent contractors.
Absolutely. The lenders definitely want to see a W-2 income person at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And there's
mm-hmm.
a lot of people, well, real estate, for instance, it's not. Outside of the real estate lending business, do you see any other sectors of employment being really impacted by the real estate downturn thus far?
It's had a huge ripple impact. It's hitting on furniture retailing.
Mm-hmm.
The Los Angeles Customs District is by value the largest point of entry for furniture imports into the United States, and the import activity at the ports is very, very slow this year. You're going to see it in all the supporting industries like title insurance, escrow companies, people who do home inspections, that type of thing. If anybody wants to do a home improvement project right about now, they're probably going to find a lot of motivated people who want to bid on that project.
I would think that's true. We're getting close to the end of this this session. One last question. Commercial real estate, it usually follows residential into the doldrums. Is this likely this time as well?
What you're seeing is that you go around Southern California, you have some non-residential real estate sectors like in Orange County. The office market is a concern. Riverside, San Bernardino. L.A. County, the office market looks good. There's strong demand. The vacancy rate is heading down, not much under construction. Then you get into the industrial market, and what you have is very, very low vacancy rates. In L.A. County, it's all of 1.8%, and there's just literally no space under construction. So as you go around, what you're finding is mixed outlooks in the non-residential sector. Some counties look very good. Other counties, you do have concerns.
Now, why the low construction if there's such a low vacancy? There's no room?
There's no land.
There's no land, okay.
That's right. People don't understand. In the urban core of L.A. and Orange County, you have run out of land. We've used a lot of land poorly. Even in the western end of the Riverside-San Bernardino area, they're running out of large chunks of land. And so we've always operated on the sort of the premise that, well, there's always a big chunk of land just right down the road. That's not true anymore.
Okay. Well, Jack, thank you so much for joining us, and we will pick this up in our next segment.
Okay, very good.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com or email questions and or comments to radio@thenorrisgroup.com. We'll see you next week here on News Talk 590 KTIE.